Welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. In this month's program, we'll follow the trail from pasture to plate. With fork and knife in hand, we will cut into stories from ranchers who produce the cattle and from chefs on how to best prepare beef. We will talk about the challenges for restaurants to buy local beef. Let's begin our journey at the American Fork Ranch in Two Dot, Montana, just outside Big Timber under the Crazy Mountains. I, along with producer Jackie Yamanaka, joined a group of 40 people, mainly ranchers, in touring this ranch, the 2015 Montana Environmental Stewardship Award winner. This year's winner was also on that tour.
I'm Lon Rukoff. I'm a cattle producer, lives north of Miles City, Montana.
We consumers conveniently find meat wrap in plastic wrap on styrofoam trays in the supermarket. But do we really think about where the prime rib with horseradish sauce or hamburger sandwiched between a soft bun comes from? Rukoff says the best beef comes from nurturing healthy cows.
All this process actually starts before the young animal is conceived. It's called prenatal nutrition. So you need to make sure that the mom is in really good shape and has a very complete diet and it is good enough physical conditions to handle the elements. So that would be the winter before the calf is conceived. Then the summer the calf is conceived, the nutrition of that cow is really important. You've got to have a very wholesome environment with a lot of different sources of forage for her to get a complete nutritional package, along with mineral supplementation, protein supplementation, when necessary. We don't do that too often. So the calf is conceived in the summer, born the next April for us. And then the nutrition of that calf and the vaccination programs, really important at a young age. A lot of the quality of the meat that people eat is formed when that calf is at a very young age or even before it's born.
So what is a cow's life cycle? After the calf is weaned, it eats grass to grow big and healthy. Annie Evgene co-manages the American Fork Ranch.
I guess I feel that we are taking good care of the land, which in return is helping us take good care of our cattle and raise a good beef product for the consumers.
When cattle are sent off to a feedlot, they eat a carefully planned and balanced diet. Lon Rukoff says that will determine the taste experience the consumer will have.
We eat both grain-finished and grass-finished beef. Grain-finished beef is a way easier to produce a highly palatable, tasty product. Grass finishing is more of an art, and it's important that the animal is harvested off of grass right when the green period is about ending. So it's a very narrow window this far north, and especially we're in a dry climate, where we can harvest that. But the majority of our calves are weaned. Sometimes we retain ownership on these cattle, and they all wind up going south, Nebraska or Kansas.
Though Montana is known for producing some of the best beef in the world, a chef's quest for locally grown beef to serve in their restaurants can be challenging. My producer, Jackie Yamanaka, asked 25-year veteran, executive chef Amy Smith of the Grand Hotel in Big Timber about locally sourcing products and certified Angus beef or CAB certified products.
For the beef, again, we want to have a consistent product. We are CAB certified. We want to have that high of product here. And I'd like grain-fed or grain-finished beef. And a lot of people definitely just want the grass-fed. Well, all beef is grass-fed. It's just that last 30 days. And I want to be able to put up a consistent product. I will special stuff out and get things in from local ranchers. And people definitely do appreciate that. But on the menu, I want to be able to have consistent product so that you can come here in the middle of the winter or in the middle of the summer and you'll be getting pretty much the same product. And it's a challenge.
Do any of the customers ask for, hey, I see a lot of cattle that's being raised. Is that what I'm eating tonight?
And again, you have to be honest. But we do, just through our beef sources, again, from CAB, It generally is from at least the western states, from the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, so at least we have that plus going for us. And, you know, we just have to keep an eye on that so that we can guarantee that.
So what do you say to, do you ever have any of the producers come to you and say, hey, I'd like to be your supplier?
Yes, we do. And again, I don't want to disappoint anybody, but I just tell them what we have, what we need. And, you know, sometimes we'll go through probably 15 tenderloins a week. That's 8 cows worth of tenderloins. And that, you know, nobody can produce that much. You know, we were going through, 12 New Yorks last week. And again, that's 6 cows worth. And it's almost impossible for a local producer to come up with that amount of product in the summertime when we go through that much of it.
This might be a difficult question to answer, but, you know, since you're right here in cattle country, since you're right here, you know, as part of this food producing region, do you feel guilty in the sense that you can't? You know, how do you make...
Again, I would love to support the local ranchers. And I truly, I think that we're promoting them enough or supporting them enough in the amount of beef that we do serve, and that all beef is supporting local ranchers, in that, you know, the more beef people eat, the more everybody has to produce, and it will keep it affordable for people to be able to eat it instead of just a once a month treat. And that's the way I got to look at it.
While Chef Amy has problems securing a reliable supply of local beef, the story is different at Montana Ale Works in Bozeman. Jackie Yamanaka sat down with executive sous chef Aaron Brittenham.
We get a lot of our product from local outlets. We go a lot through Gallatin Valley Botanicals. They're a small farm about 3 miles away from the restaurant. And we get all of our burgers from Montana Wagyu Cattle Company. We do, of course, have to still get some product from national purveyors. We're a very large restaurant, and there isn't quite enough in Bozeman to supply us with everything that we need. But as much as we can, we try and work with local farms and ranchers to get higher quality produce and meats and... you know, put our money back into the local economy.
When I was talking with Chef Amy yesterday at the Grand, she said, well, she would like to do that. She's not able to do that because she just can't get the supply for the number of plates. Can you talk about, I mean, challenges, etc.?
Well, I mean, one great example of how we do make it work is with Montana Wagyu Cattle Company. Rick, the rancher, was selling all of his tenderloins and ribeyes and strip loins. He was having no problem selling that with Wagyu. People will pay top dollar for that. But the ground beef, he was having a lot harder of a time to move. So that was something a few years ago. He and Roth, the chef owner, kind of worked together and collaborated to make this Montana Ale Works ground beef program. And we've got a premier blend that all of our burgers are 50% Wagyu, which is dry-aged for 21, 28 days, 50% Black Angus. And it was kind of a mutual benefit where he had a large amount of product that he was having a hard time selling. And we were selling a lot of hamburgers and at the time charging extra for a local burger. But with this program, we were actually able to have all of our hamburgers be locally produced, have our cows are 15 miles or so away in Belgrade. The furthest away they ever get is ranchland processing in Butte. So that was kind of just a mutual benefit of a local purveyor who had some product that he needed to get rid of, and us being able to find a source to allow more of our product to be local.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, can you pay the producer a little bit more, you know, to get that product, and then you market it as such at Montana Ale Works, and then charge the customer a little bit more, and they know exactly, I mean, is that important? Can you, you know, make that economic circle?
Yeah, and we're we're able to kind of, at least this time of year during the summer, have a lot of our products be local, and we kind of keep the same price point. I'm sure you're familiar with Montana Ale Works, and we are very busy, do a lot of business, we sell a lot of food. So we're actually able to, you know, this time of year, even, you know, our salad greens on our house salad come from Gallatin Valley Botanicals just down the street, and our arugula in our salads comes from Gallatin Valley Botanicals right down the street. Our baby carrots this time of year come from Gallatin Valley Botanicals right down the street, and they taste so much better. They're unfortunately only available for a few months a year, but we are able to kind of just pass that on to the customer, and with our increased summer volumes, we're able to not change our menu prices and have the vast majority of the produce on our menu be local.
So for other restaurants that would maybe like to do this, and any advice on how to get locally sourced, knowing there's only so much and maybe not having to make the Costco run? You know, where we're running out of, you know, baby greens. Hurry up, get down to Costco, go get some.
I would just say get out there and talk to your farmers, talk to your ranchers. They want to get their product out there as much as, you know, you want to sell local product. And it's a fact that things taste better when they're, you know, when the salad comes out of the ground yesterday and is on the customer's plate today, it tastes better. It's fresher. It didn't get bagged up in California and then shipped to Seattle and then from Seattle to Billings. There's not that time for it to kind of sweat on itself and, you know, just get a couple days older. It tastes better. That's, you know, that's what people want. I think if you need to charge more, people are willing to pay an extra dollar or two for nice local produce, and the local farmers and ranchers want to sell it. They want to sell it locally. It's less expensive for somebody in Belgrade to sell something to Bozeman than it is to sell it to Boston, for example. So I would, you know, take some time and get out and talk to your ranchers, talk to your farmers, and see what you guys can work out together.
So, but you are not, say, buying and then having to make your own ground beef, though, right? You're getting the product already ground from.
Yeah, we get it already ground. We actually get our burgers already patted. You know, it's Ranchland Processing in Butte takes care of that end of it.
Wow. Okay. Anything else you'd like to add? You know, again, I'm real interested in, you know, closing that circle where, you know, folks can see the cattle out as they are driving the roads of Montana, and then finding somewhere, you know, whether it's a supermarket or a restaurant, to say, hey, that potentially was that from that rancher down the street.
Yeah, it's a very cool thing, and I mean, and then I would say to people too, you know, find a local farm, find a local ranch, and go see it for yourself. You know, these people, any rancher I've met or any farmer I've talked to, they're all excited to tell their stories about local produce. And I'm, from what I can't make any promises, but from the ranchers that I've met, they'd be happy to have you on your ranch. And you know, go meet your cow, go meet your burger, go meet your salads before they're on your plate. It's a neat thing. And I think everyone from the ranchers to the chefs, farmers, everyone is just as excited about it as consumers who are interested in local product are.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me.
Yeah, thank you.
We will leave this first part of the show encouraging you to get to know who grows your food, in this case, beef. Behind every ribeye or hamburger is a rancher dedicated to raising safe, wholesome food for our tables. In the second half of this show, we'll explore how to cook and showcase beef. We'll get advice on this from three chefs, and we'll visit with Chef Alan Michaud, introducing his Montana Meat Collective.
We are supported by Zonta Club of Billings, dedicated to advancing women's education, equality, health, and wellness. Providing grants for community agencies, student scholarships, local nonprofit assistance, and awareness and education for domestic violence and human trafficking.
Welcome back to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. In the second half of this show, we visit with chefs Mike Arison, Alan Michaud, and Eric Traeger. We begin with executive chef Mike Arison from Austin, Texas. Currently, he is the culinary arts instructor for the Burnett High School Culinary Arts Program. We sat down before the tour at the Homestead Bed and Breakfast in Big Timber to talk about how he became interested in cooking.
So I grew up watching my mom, and my mom was an incredible cook, and you know, she just basically would throw these things together, and I would sit and watch, and I was always gravitated to the kitchen. You know, it was something that I loved doing with my mom, and she passed away very early in my life, and it's something today that I still hold on to. She, when I was in college, she passed away a week before I got married, and I moved home and she had cancer, and still today when I think about cooking, I think of some of the dishes that my mom did with me in the kitchen.
And what were some of those dishes?
Well, now I would call it bœuf à la bourguignon, but back then it was basically braised beef, and it was basically, you know, I grew up in the boiler bag generation, which is sad to say, but she also did some of that, but she really did a lot of things from scratch, and one of her big things was, you know, cooking, braising things, and big cuts of meat. We had a family of four, and she was always looking at ways that she could stretch a dish or stretch a piece of meat to last three or four meals. And, you know, cooking crock pot and things like that were always a great way to feed a family when you didn't have a lot of money, and also to get nutritious whole foods versus buying things that were frozen or buying things that were pre-made.
Right. Did she allow you in the kitchen? Did you actually help her?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I got to stay there as long as I wanted, and I would stand up on a stool and basically, you know, get in there, and I do the same thing with my daughter now. She pretty much grew up in a kitchen when I taught at Le Cordon Bleu, and then at home, she's really interested. She's a foodie. She watches all the food channels. And
how old is she?
She's 12 years old now.
But even with many years of cooking and degrees from the Culinary Institute of America and Johnson & Wales University, he says he's always learning.
You can never learn everything there is to know about food, and that's the beauty of, you know, once you get done with one cuisine, you start to focus on another one, and you get a new passion, and now, right now, Asian cuisine and beef is my passion, so it's interesting to see. There's a couple places in Austin that do some Korean Tex-Mex fusion tacos, and the beef taco with Korean flavors is just, I love it.
Well, it sounds like you actually have that worldly flair with food.
I've been very lucky because, you know, just, and I say lucky, I believe God puts you in places where you're meant to be, and I've got to experience some pretty neat things, and I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Chef Mike is the co-producer of the movie True Beef from Pasture to Plate. The film highlights Texas beef through the eyes of high school culinary and agricultural students.
Part of the Pasture to the Plate tour really inspired me to share some things that I didn't know, that as an adult, and I tried to emulate to my students, said, look, I've been cooking and working in restaurants for a long time, but I hate to admit, I'd never been to an actual ranch and talked to a rancher or farmer about their practices and seen how they did things. And that involved into me kind of invigorating, what can I do with beef? And what are some of the different things that and techniques that are happening right now with the, you know, the science side of sous vide and cooking steaks in a bag, which is some people would say was sacrilege. And then there's some people that argue it's the best steak you'll ever have in your life. And that's where you see perspective. I've been trying to work with as many different cuts of beef as I can just to kind of experiment with things that I hadn't normally done, like cheek meat and things like I'm doing a demonstration tomorrow on bavette, which is the sirloin flap, which ironically some chefs and when I was talking to people about it, you'll hear different perspectives on how it's processed, where it comes from, what it's called. Part of the True Beef film and project we did was getting young people excited about butchery again and understanding that this steak doesn't just arrive miraculously at the grocery store, that someone had to take some time to raise it and the passion that goes behind that and then actually butchering it so that it becomes something we can eat. And butchery, I mean, I wouldn't claim to be a butcher. I've done butchering in restaurants, but butchering is a whole other craft.
Right.
And there's butchers out there that are just phenomenal in the things that they know how to do. But there's a shortage of old school whole animal butchery that is something that I think is making a comeback in the United States and a lot of the cities in Portland area, in New York, in Boston, and there's some places in Austin. Salt and Thyme is just out of this world. And they do whole animal butchery and they do charcuterie. What we call Texas charcuterie, but it's old school methods that they're bringing back and getting younger generations to explore. How do you use everything and respect the animal and respect the life that it gave that a lot of cultures outside of the United States already do.
Right.
That unfortunately as Americans, we've become a little detached from our food. And I always joke with my kids, it's like in America, they don't like to see the head or the feet or anything or feathers, skin on anything. And you go to other countries and you'll see whole rabbits, whole chickens, right. You know, feet still on, head on fish, that it's something that it's a cultural thing that I think is slowly evolving as people get more experimental with food and really trust their chefs and trust their butchers and trust their purveyors or ranchers that, hey, this is amazing food. You got to try this. This is cool. And just put away all the preconceived notions and biases and give it a shot. I mean, in Texas, the joke is if I told you what was in tamales, you would probably not want to eat it, but right, it's the most right. delicious. I mean, they're addictive. Tamales in Texas, they're just delicious, but it's an old school way. And barbacoa is the same way, you know, it's
using all parts and eating everything and
utilizing it right. and making it into something delicious. So.
For the everyday consumer, butchering is accessible. Chef Allen from Helena is currently laying the groundwork for the Montana Meat Collective. This new concept is emerging in cities on both coasts. The idea connects producers directly with consumers. A group of people can buy an animal and then get together to learn to butcher the animal into usable cuts and parts.
It's a classroom of maybe 12 students, learning different cuts of meats.
And you're actually doing the actual butchering?
Per se, yes. They get instructed by a butcher on the different primal cuts, and then from the primal cuts, it goes down to subprimal cuts. And they between each primal, they'll go to their table and do hands-on on cutting down.
And what do you see as the importance of learning about these various cuts?
Well, it's to learn where your product, what you're eating, you know, where the product is and the muscle group and where it comes from. And
you mean eating beef is not just filet mignon?
No, there's a whole lot more to it than that. And where does that filet mignon come from, right?
That is correct. And do you also tell people as to what the best ways are to perhaps prepare these parts?
The butcher will be doing that, yes.
So this is a great resource. Where did you come up with this idea?
This idea is coming up around the country. There's a few on the West Coast now, like Portland Meat Collective, Seattle Meat Collective, El Dorado Meat Collective.
So this is, again, great information to be brought back to Montana. You don't have it quite started yet, but it is plans for the future.
Plans for the future, yes. I'm just putting it all in place right now. So.
Okay, well, great. Thank you so much, Alan.
Oh, thank you.
Now that we have our cuts of beef, let's visit with Executive Chef Eric Traeger of the Old Piney Dell at the Rock Creek Resort for some of his thoughts on preparing beef. Is there salt, no salt, marination, aging?
Of course, it's, again, with its being organic. I try and do with, we have a nice quality product, just salt and pepper, sometimes a little bit of fresh thyme. If it is a well-marbled cut of meat, I will grill it. If it tends to be a little leaner, I tend to pan sear and a little bit of clarified butter. So a hotter temperature and just sear in the juices and brings out some strong flavor of the beef itself.
I love that addition of butter, just to add a little bit more fattiness and savoriness to it. How about your cooking methods? What do you prefer?
Wow. Yes, I guess with the short ribs, I like to sear the outside, caramelize it, and then slow roast it or slow braise it in the oven 4 or 5 hours. I make smoked brisket, which I tend to smoke with mesquite for about 6 hours, and then I finish that in the oven again, braising it for another 6 hours so it's nice and tender. Something like a tenderloin, pan sear it just rare, season it with salt, pepper, brings out, again, the clarified butter. Brings out some more flavor into the beef.
So for the everyday cook, do you have some words of advice for cooking beef?
Well, first, get a good source of beef. You know, if you can get some from a local ranch that can process your beef at a local butchery, that's ideal. Even some butcheries have a lot of local beef that you can purchase. Gosh, I guess each cut of meat is so unique and different. It's really learning that knowledge of when you have a tough cut of meat, it's low and slow. If you have, highly marbled meat, maybe it's high and fast, so you can really just sear the outside, get that nice crispy coat on the outside, and just nice and tender and moist on the inside.
So how do we continue good cooking into the future? Chef Mike has this insight.
Culinary schools are great, and I think they serve a purpose, and you can be successful a lot of different ways. But apprenticeship is also a good way that I wish I would have done a formal apprenticeship before or after culinary school for 2 to 3 years, because it just would have made that much more of an impact.
That hands-on
and
experience.
Hands-on. And
yeah.
Everywhere else in the world, that's the way they do it. So it's time for us to bring that back to the United States and have it be more formalized. And I know there's many chefs in the country that have been instrumental in creating that, and a lot of them were my teachers at CIA, which I'm honored and respectful of. But it's time to bring it back again and give that opportunity to the next generation so that they can bring some of the craft back that is, it's being lost. And
yes,
Austin's very cool, and I love it because I think that we're the only place in the world that's fermenting and butchering and doing all, but it's happening everywhere. But Austin's been a very trendy city to bring back some of the old world techniques and doing
involving
fermentation and using offal and doing farm to table and
yes,
farm to plate. And it's happening all over the United States, and that's, Texas is not unique. Everywhere does it. It's just cool to see it being in a resurgence.
Yeah, it is. And it's great to see it somewhere in Texas and Montana, and we're just all evolving, and hopefully people are just more aware and more appreciative of the food that we have here.
Absolutely. And I think that's the number one thing is to, I say, respect the food and respect the farmers and ranchers, because without those farmers and ranchers, which make up about 1% of the United States right now, and it scares me to think that half of that percent may retire or not be here in the next 15 or 20 years, they're putting food on our plates and in our tables. And I thank God every day for the job I get to do, but I wouldn't get to do what I do over the last 30 years, whether it be teaching or working restaurants or cooking it, if it wasn't for the farmers and ranchers in the United States of America. And I don't think they get enough praise for what they do, because they work 7 days a week. They can't leave their ranch or their farm. They are, a rancher today said they gamble every single day of their lives, because Mother Nature can ruin a crop or be detrimental to a herd or change all kinds of things that are out of their control. But every morning they wake up and still do it, which just blows my mind how dedicated they are to their animals and also to feeding America and the world.
Tonight, with fork and knife in hand, as you slice into the meat on your plate, think about who grew the food before you and who cooked in the deliciousness. Thank you for traveling with me from Pasture the Plate. The producer for Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region, is Jackie Yamanaka. Our theme music is by Parker Brown. For more information about this program and links, go to our website, yipradio.org. I'm Stella Fong.